The Army created its Pinyon Canyon maneuver site in southeastern Colorado in the 1980s. It was still the Cold War, and the Pentagon identified a shortage of training land at Fort Carson as weapons and tactics evolved. Through a series of public meetings and land acquisitions, the Army established the training site, but left a bitter taste in the mouths of many locals. More than 20 years later, in 2006, the Army announced plans to expand the site, an act that spurred folks into organized resistance, which was eventually successful. That resistance is the subject of a recent paper from two professors in Colorado Springs, who looked at the strategies employed by both the military and the opposition. UCCS Professor of Geography and Environmental Studies David Havlick and Colorado College Professor of Southwest Studies Eric Paramond sat down with KRCC News Director Andrea Chalfin earlier this year to discuss their paper.
What is it that you actually looked at, and how did you go about doing it, David?
We end up looking at, broadly, the controversy over the proposed expansion of the Pinyon Canyon maneuver site that the U.S. Army was proposing. And I think we found we were both attending some of the hearings in town that were going on surrounding it and realized we might have some overlapping research interests that we could pursue. And I think we were just kind of intrigued more generally about what's going on here and what are the stories that are being told about this expansion, because we had the Army on one hand saying this is important for reasons of national security and it's the right thing to do. And then we had a population of ranchers across southeastern Colorado that's saying absolutely not the right thing to do. We don't want to see another acre devoted to military use, and we're going to resist it to the very end. And so we're drawn into that tension between what in the past had been a ranching population fairly sympathetic to security concerns and to the military, who suddenly seemed to have switched sides and was saying, we're opposing military expansion.
Yeah, I mean, I think the tricky part of this was writing a story largely from a one-sided, one-voiced kind of narrative, because most of what we were getting was from the Pinyon Canyon opposition coalition that we had been in touch with. And any time we tried to get an official story or narrative out of the Army, we basically were stonewalled, or it was very difficult to get any kind of accessible information or even perspective on this issue other than what was being kind of released or leaked by the PCEOC that was opposed to the expansion site.
And PCEOC is Pinyon Canyon Expansion Opposition Coalition.
That's correct, yeah.
Okay. Why is it actually important to look at something like this, Eric?
I mean, in some ways, I think part of it was we started with the open curiosity about it, and it was really, for me, just a teachable kind of aspect for class instruction. But over time, we started talking more and more about, you know, what is the relative importance of this small move at the same time that, you know, especially David's scholarship addresses this, you know, base closure, conversions of ex-military sites into nature reserves. And we thought, is this sort of the latest incarnation of a kind of a Western range war, but in a totally different way than might have been expected back in the 50s through the 80s? And so I think, you know, what I thought was compelling, and I think certainly David spotted earlier, is this interesting narrative about how attitudes in the West had really changed. So if the Old West, the Cold War West, was much more embracing of the military presence and willing to live next to, you know, military exercise sites, I think that time had sort of largely either passed or things had shifted even since the Reagan era when PCMS, the maneuver site, was opened down in southeastern Colorado. And I think it was a kind of a misread by the Army to try to even propose expanding in a place that had already been problematic even when they established themselves down there.
David.
What I found important about it were two main pieces. One was a lot of my research has looked at base closures, as Eric mentioned, and how since 1988 we've had systematic processes of closing bases across the country. More than 400 sites have been closed in the last 25 years. And yet here in Colorado, we were looking at an active effort to expand a base. But then when I looked at it, I think at the first glance, I just assumed, oh, well, the Army will prevail here. Of course they'll expand. And as time started to pass, I think both Eric and I started to get the sense that the Army didn't seem to be winning. And so that, too, then became intriguing. Well, what's going on? How is it that what seemed to be kind of a ragtag collection of ranchers is actually gaining the upper hand in this debate over whether the Army should be allowed to expand or not?
Eric, you mentioned attitudes, cultural shifts from the Cold War to 2000s. Was it a culture shift, or did the culture shift happen because of a lack of transparency on the part of the military?
Yeah, I think it's both. I mean, you're really pinpointing something that is kind of important to remember folks who basically were not around at that time. You know, 1983, that's still at the tail end of the Cold War, but we didn't know that then. And so the setup of a maneuver site occurs right in the 80s during, you know, the Reagan era, when we really were still concerned about possible total nuclear war and all these concerns about sort of expansion of the Soviet Union and how do you counter that. So in some ways, you know, we didn't really quite see 5 or 6 years down the road that the entire Soviet Union would collapse and the entire reason why you'd basically have a PCMS in the middle of southeastern Colorado would sort of disappear. And I think in some ways that's why it took so long for the military to even think about an expansion, is that what was our new purpose? And it took 30-something years to figure out, oh, yeah, there's a war on terror. And so I think that shift is simultaneously across all fronts, too. It's not necessarily that we went from, you know, a different kind of rancher to a different kind of rancher from the 80s to now. But I think the attitudes towards further expansion was also kind of a broken promise that at the time they'd promised local ranchers that this would be it. They would not use eminent domain. This is as much as they needed, period. And then to have that, you know, sort of go back on them 30 years later, I think a lot of ranchers sort of felt betrayed, as well as some of the folks who got involved. And some of those were just artists down in Trinidad, and then some teachers and folks like that who were really concerned about what would happen to southeastern Colorado and would it become like the next empty quarter of the United States, another sort of depopulated sacrifice zone for more maneuvers.
David.
And I think Eric mentioned kind of that sense of betrayal surrounding 1983. There were also promises to have no live fire, and the Army went back on that and started doing live fire exercises. There also was at least a broad promise of economic benefit to the region, that they said if he allows to expand here, it's going to really benefit southeastern Colorado. And over time, it became clear that there really was no broad economic benefit, that whatever expansion of personnel and associated revenues that were produced through that all centered upon Colorado Springs and the main base of Fort Carson. So for all those reasons, I think there was a different cultural response to the idea of expansion that didn't happen in 1983. And I think also, I mean, it's sort of ironic because the expansion argument that the Army put forward was really predicated upon a post-Cold War logic that we now need more nimble, more highly maneuverable tactical units. It was all about sort of this revolutionary military affairs that emerged in the late 90s and early 2000s. And yet they didn't recognize that there might also be a shift in post-Cold War attitudes and receptiveness by the ranchers. So the Army, at one hand, was responding to a new geopolitical context, but ignoring kind of the sociopolitical context.
You're talking about some of these multiple identities, I guess, of the Pinyon Canyon opposition folks. They employed both of these identities of this down-home cowboy, the rugged individual, and yet at the same time, it's technologically savvy. What kind of roles do those, David, play in the actual success of the movement?
Well, I think it brought their plight into a lot more different people's lives than if they had just been kind of bringing forward the concern of this is a traditional livelihood that could be lost. It didn't end there. So whether you care about ranching or not, their multiplicity of approaches started to bring you into sort of the domain of concern. One way they responded to the argument that the Army was bringing forward that expansion was needed for national security reasons was by saying, well, national security can look different in different contexts. And so we actually are providing for national security by producing food for the nation. So we grow crops and we raise cattle. And that's a national security concern. It's not just about the movement of armored vehicles or testing munitions that equals national security. So that was one way that tapping into kind of a more diverse understanding of what a rancher did or what their role in society is helped move their argument forward into more people's lives.
Eric, do you have anything you want to add?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was not only a diverse kind of coalition, but they also moved and adapted as sort of the message was either ignored or had less traction between 06 and 2010, especially when they were doing really high-level campaigning against the expansion and the sort of a quiet period between 2010 and 2013, where there's rumblings once in a while about leaked things, but it sort of settled a bit until they sort of permanently killed it, we thought, with sort of the removal of funding and sort of saying that this will not be brought up again. We're seeing that come back again. But I think that one of the best tactics, and we try to highlight this aspect in the piece, is this aspect of counter-cartography, right? Sort of going and say, okay, well, you're saying you're not going to use eminent domain, we'll go out and try to find some willing sellers for you. And identifying on a map in red and putting in red that, oh, those are unwilling sellers. So what are you going to do? Are you going to use eminent domain or not? And so I think that aspect of using counter cartography, maps basically as weapons, to go against a weapon, sort of this message that the Army had, well, it's empty, we need it for national security. They forced the issue over this notion of property and who owns what, and that was going to force their hand. And the Army really doesn't, and the U.S. federal government in general, doesn't want to use eminent domain, especially on private property. That would be pretty problematic.
And just as a visual, the map that was included in the paper is the whole area is pretty much surrounded in red, meaning these are unwilling sellers.
Correct. Yeah.
To that point, I think one of the interesting strategies that actually was not utilized was sort of the parallel narrative of what happened on those lands, a century ago. And was that a conscious decision on their part? And to what end? Why not engage that story?
Well, I think they did, but in sometimes awkward ways. And I will say that, hearing a white rancher on an expansion opposition coalition say something like, well, now we're the Indians, is a little startling in the sense that, most of that open range was cleared out by the Army of previous Native inhabitants. And so the fact that you used to have Arapaho and Cheyenne and Kiowa and even Ute closer to the mountains, peoples occupying that region. We just commemorated 150 years after the Sand Creek Massacre last fall. So the fact that they were trying occasionally to use this language of, now we are the Indians too and getting dispossessed by the same army that once helped us clear these great plains. Oh, so I don't think that message carried forth, aggressively. But you heard that occasionally, this sort of notion that now we're being subjected to the same kinds of strategies of displacement in a much more subtle, technocratic way, obviously. But I think that was one of maybe the more problematic kind of language uses occasionally.
Yeah, and I think it's striking that the ranchers, their coalition, the history that they drew upon really started towards the end of the indigenous occupancy. And so the way they invoked historical concerns was saying, the Santa Fe Trail ran through this area, or their settler homesteads that would be destroyed or isolated. It didn't go earlier than that, and I think for reasons of fit, it was more awkward to get into what's the indigenous treatment in history here. The rancher story really begins when the Indians have been mostly cleared out.
Obviously, the PCEOC has a motivation for supplying documents to you. Did you find that when you were eventually able to get access via the Army that they actually matched up, that they were, genuine in terms of what was supplied by either side?
Well, in terms of the Army documents that the PCEOC posted, very much so, they were the same documents that were later proven to be legitimate, and they would post them with the Army's seal and all that. That was fairly clear even from the outset that these are true copies that have been scanned and put up there. The Army never really did come out with a map showing an aspiration to expand almost 7 million acres in southeast Colorado. That was only through the paper in La Junta and the PCEOC and the Not One Acre More, these other coalitions that were out there trying to fight the expansion. So in some cases, it just wasn't even possible to compare documents, although the maps that the opposition folks created did match with the descriptions that the Army had included in some of the documents that were leaked.
I mean, to do like a sort of more recent analogy for all this is that it's hard to tell a one-sided story, right? So imagine if Edward Snowden had released all these documents, but there had been no public response from the federal government to the release of those documents, none whatsoever. That's basically what happened with the PCEOC and sort of that, at least this particular episode of expansion, is that there really wasn't much of an official narrative coming out of the Army.
Do you think there was an actual conscious strategy, or do you think they were caught off guard?
Who knows? The problem is that we never got an official narrative from them. No story, really, informally. You would occasionally get a Fort Carson representative at some of the public events that PCEOC would organize on various campuses, and so there would always be like an officer sitting in the back quietly. And I think I even threw in a quote in the piece about, the person was doing a live interview after this representative from Fort Carson with one of the local news crews and started to say, some various quotes. And as soon as he noticed us like taking notes or, being there, they would all shut down or say, well, let's take this elsewhere. So even in the moment where you think you would have some kind of point to communicating your message, and they're clearly talking to journalists, any third party was viewed as sort of like a moment to sort of exit that conversation. So it was a bit shocking to see that there was no even official story.
And I mean, the Army did at times have hearings to try to meet with, especially the southeastern Colorado populations, but most of those were characterized more by denial than openness. And so, you know, I think the closest they ever came to acknowledging this leaked map that really galvanized the resistance, I think the most the Army ever said was that was an unauthorized map.
Do you think, you know, in this particular instance, I mean, any further hope of potential expansion is thwarted by just the legacy of what's happened there in the past?
That's a tougher question.
My sense is the Army still sees southeastern Colorado as a juicy piece of terrain, that they haven't actually given up on their interest in expanding, and that they'll pursue it in other guises, other forms. You know, I think the technology card will continue to be played. We have new technologies we need to test and utilize for the safety of our soldiers and for their national defense. And this is a big chunk of land without very many people in it, and so we think this is a priority site for what we want to do. So, no, I don't think it's the end of the story.
Just for a little bit of a context, both of you are coming to this with an interest in military sites and an interest in this idea of the militarization of the West. And what are some other sites that are worth noting, and what actually sets this particular one apart?
A lot of my other work looks at sites that have closed and are transitioning to new uses. So the Rocky Mountain Arsenal is one place where I've spent a lot of time just outside of Denver, that former chemical weapons manufacturing facility that is now a national wildlife refuge. Rocky Flats near Boulder is another site. It was a former nuclear weapons production facility, now a national wildlife refuge. And I think when we look at places like that, there's a temptation to imagine that we're demilitarizing the West, that we're going from militarized sites to wildlife or conservation-oriented sites. But I think those other layers persist. Even these areas that are now wildlife refuges are still very much militarized spaces with restricted uses and legacies of contamination that will persist in some cases for 24,000 years, the half-life of plutonium, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think one message I would sort of encourage out of all this, too, is to dig deeper, to think more deeply about how it's not just kind of the superficial current contemporary expression of a landscape that matters, but it's the various historical layers and socioeconomic layers of power even that are expressed in the landscape.
Yeah, the militarization of the West is not a one-shot deal or an era that is already closed. It's really a palimpsest, right? Is that this template will get laid over in different. So it's a cumulative, additive process. And on my side, it's sort of those interests of either former nuclear test sites or places that are currently, you know, weapons labs like Los Alamos down in New Mexico, and sort of their current effects, or alienating parts of what is Los Alamos National Laboratories away from, you know, nearby Pueblo Indian peoples. And so that aspect of the militarization of the West is a cumulative one, not an episodic and closed one. And that's sort of what sparked this interest.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's also important to consider militarized landscapes in broader ways. So even, I mean, one of the big recent pushes by the military in Colorado is to get access to high elevation landing sites and testing areas for helicopter flights. And so, I mean, we have 14ers and 13,000 foot peaks now that in a real sense are becoming militarized landscapes because of the helicopter flights and flyovers and the maneuvers that are taking place. So, I mean, if you look at just the ground level or at one kind of layer, these are wilderness areas, some of our most pristine kind of protected sites that you wouldn't imagine to be also militarized landscapes. And so I think trying to encourage a more robust or nuanced understanding of what it even means for a place to become militarized is worthwhile and important.
But I think one of the arguments that the Army makes is that we need the high altitude training. We need the different landscapes to be able to train our troops to do what they need to do. How, I mean, do you think that there is a balance, or will these tensions always exist in some form or another?
I think there absolutely will persist. There be persistent tensions. I mean, as long as we live in a country where we're determined to defend what we have, whatever that means to you, whether that means democracy or access to resources or to a certain livelihood, And as long as national defense, therefore, is important, we will need spaces where we can train our troops and test our weapons and be ready to assert that defensive or offensive capability.
That was KRCC's Andrea Chalfin speaking with UCCS Professor of Geography and Environmental Studies David Havlick and Colorado College Professor of Southwest Studies Eric Paramond. Their paper was published earlier this year in the British journal Environment and Planning D, Society and Space, and focuses on the strategies employed by both the Army and the resistance to expansion of the Pinyon Canyon maneuver site in the late 2000s. At the time that interview was recorded, the Army was undergoing a required review process for expanded training at the maneuver site, which has since been approved. The Army expressly stated that the expanded training would not require a physical expansion of the site. Many of the nearby residents say it's only a matter of time. Others express support of the changes, saying that the military simply has to have somewhere to train as strategies and technologies continue to evolve. Full disclosure, Colorado College is KRCC's licensee. This is The Big Something. We'll be right back.